Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio, the only program of its kind in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, Teamsters Local 206. All too often we hear of corporations planning to eliminate jobs and close plants as they restructure. For example, last week, Kraft Foods announced it would eliminate 8,000 jobs, about 8% of its workforce, and close up to 20 production plants as Kraft broadens its ongoing restructuring effort. It's been said that one of the reasons behind the restructuring is the underutilization of existing facilities. Now, some things we might think of when we hear that 8,000 people will lose their jobs is that now there will be 8,000 more families without health care, 8,000 more children without health care, more part-time jobs will be needed to cover the loss in wages, and will there be money for college? Not the things we used to think of when we said the words, the American dream. Is there another side to this story of the 8,000, more than the impact to those workers and their families? I think so. And what does a company mean when it says the reason it is closed, it is eliminating 8,000 jobs, is underutilization of existing facilities? What impact does restructuring have on the remaining workforce? You know, those lucky enough to keep their jobs. Later in tonight's program, we'll be talking to Robert Schwartz. Bob has represented unions and employees for 20 years and has authored many books, which we will talk about tonight. And also Washington State Senator Karen Kaiser on legislation she introduced called the Fair Share Bill. But first on Labor Radio tonight, we have Lonnie Golden. Lonnie is an associate professor of economics and labor studies from Penn State University. Lonnie is also with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Lonnie, welcome back to Labor Radio.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Well, we're glad to have you here. So some businesses are closing plants, shifting jobs mostly overseas, but to other plants inside the country. When they shift this type of work, does that mean that other workers are going to often end up working longer hours?
It is often the case that when firms are cutting back or have trouble recruiting and training new workers, that in the interim period, which can go on for a very long time, they require heavy loads of overtime work.
Right. Now, and this has been increasing in the last decade?
It seems to have. We don't get a measure of this every year, but I'm authoring a series of studies with a co-author, Barbara Wienstoers from Penn State Altoona. And she and I are finding in a data set that was collected in 2002 that indeed it's a slightly higher percentage of the workforce that is now working under or subject to these mandatory overtime work conditions. It now amounts to about one in five workers that face this, and many, if not most of them, actually work additional work hours because it is required by the employer.
Right. So what we're seeing is the trend over the past 10, 15 years in increased overtime for workers.
It looks like it's at a higher level of the workforce than it was the last time we measured this comprehensively in the U.S. workforce about 20-some years ago. So it is slightly higher.
And is the U.S. higher than other industrialized nations?
Hard to determine that. We know that in most of the English-speaking countries of the world and in many of the Asian countries, the workweek length seems to be growing or increasing, at least for a large segment of the workforce. At the other end of the spectrum, of course, there are a lot of workers who are hungry for more work hours or are totally out of a job. So it's this polarization that's really the trend that's been occurring.
Right. So it seems like we have less people working, but more people working longer hours.
I think that's fair to say that there's a growing percentage of the workforce that puts in long hours, and a pretty good chunk of that is because those hours, additional hours, are required by the employer. A lot of them, of course, are voluntary, so a lot of the story is that wages, as you know, have not kept up with inflation year after year. Consequently, workers who have the privilege, in a sense, of working additional hours can do so to keep their income levels up. But it takes its toll if you work longer hours, if it's voluntary, and particularly when it's not voluntary.
Right. So, I mean, you know, as things go today on a standard 40-hour week, and then your car breaks down or your furnace doesn't work, or maybe you actually get your gas bill for the month, and I'm talking about natural gas to heat your house or even gas in your car, it's kind of nice to say, hey, I think I'll work a few extra hours this month and put some more money in the bank so that I can pay these bills.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but oftentimes we're not just talking about a few more hours per month.
There is a limit to that, and a lot of the issue about overtime work, and particularly the mandatory overtime work, boils down to the extent to which it's voluntary. So if you're a worker who needs the extra income, you know, short term, like you say, stopgap for the budget, that's one thing. But when it's extra hours that are loaded on week after week, month after month, that begins to take its toll in a variety of fashions that are unwelcome for most workers, you know, the health and safety and injury issues.
Right. But I think the other thing that happens, and what I notice, is that whether or not you want to work the hours, you become accustomed, let's say, to working those hours. And I don't want to say become accustomed to working the hours. You become accustomed and used to the paychecks.
It's entirely human and very natural.
Yeah.
And that's been going on for decades, that once you get your standard of living a little bit higher, it's very hard to adjust downward. So it does become part of one's lifestyle.
So it's a vicious cycle that you've gotten yourself into.
It is, and it should be noted that a lot of folks who work this additional work hours are not necessarily on hourly pay. So folks are on monthly salary or just basic annual salary jobs. A surprising share of the workers who say they work overtime because it's required by their employer are on salary. So they're putting it in to protect their jobs or maybe to position themselves better for promotion or, like you say, to continue to bring in the stream of income that they need and really feel obliged by the nature of the job, not just their employer or workplace, to put in these additional hours. And it does become, in a sense, part of the lifestyle and habit forming, in the sense that it'd be hard to imagine cutting back on hours.
To actually just living on an actual 40-hour paycheck.
There are other surveys I've been analyzing which ask people directly, would you trade income for time off? And depending on how the question's framed, you get a pretty substantial share of the workforce that says yes. But you're looking at, or you find that that's mainly among those with very high incomes that can afford to take off, let's say, a day per week, or they're in the type of occupations where they're already working very long hours. So if they could get back to a standard 40-hour work week, they would find that really attractive and might be prepared to sacrifice the income to go along with that. But mostly the folks who work in jobs that are paid by the hour, they're more than likely to want more hours rather than fewer.
Right, because, again, you want to raise your standard of living. I mean, I talked a little bit about the American dream.
Right.
The home, the car, kids in college, health care, you know, dental, vision, all that type of thing. And it's, you know, even if you have a decent paying job in today's economy, it's tough to hang on to all that stuff.
It sure is. I mean, and some people, you know, continue to work the longer hours mainly as a defense mechanism, either protect their own job or maybe quite rationally build up some savings or get out of debt so that that doesn't become at risk if you are laid off or cut back. Mm. On the other hand, I think one of the underlying pressures of this work phenomenon is that we used to want to keep up with the Joneses, and the Joneses were pretty much about at our income level. But there is that phenomenon where the top 1% is pulling away from the rest of us in terms of income and wealth levels, and it's almost impossible to keep up with the Gateses.
Or the Bushes. Throw that in there a little bit. So I go to work, and I'm working 40 hours, and the boss comes out and says, hey, I need you to stay over a few hours tonight, and I say, okay, and I stay over. That's one thing. How do we define excessive overtime? I mean, is there a limit? Is there a point at which we say, okay, now you're becoming, you know, all these fatigue and health and all the other aspects of negative aspects of overtime come in? Is there a point at which you can say, yeah, that's here, or no, it's not here?
That's a great question. I mean, the answer is yes, but it varies by individual in one's capacity, and it varies by the type of work and the type of occupation. But certainly, there is a point at which, if hours get long, let's say in a given day, that fatigue will set in and stress sets in. Again, it depends on what industry or what type of job is being studied. But for some jobs, even after 8 or 9 hours, you see a higher risk of accident or medical errors or risk of injury, and even more pronounced after about 11 hours. On the other hand, there are ways to mitigate this, so that if you're talking about somebody who's working a 12-hour shift, but they were off the previous day, and they're going to be off the next day because they're allowed to compress their work week, then you see much less risk of this. In fact, those kind of compressed work weeks are pretty popular with a lot of workers, to work 12 hours and over 3 or 4 days rather than over 5. So it's a question of how many consecutive days in a row you're on long hours, how many consecutive hours in a day, and how much and the quality of your rest and recuperation you get in between work shifts.
So if you're working 7 hour day or 7 days a week, 12 hour days is not the way to go. Or if you're working 22 days in a row before you get 2 days off, that's also not a way to go, is that?
I think there are some definite risks of that. Again, it depends on the working conditions, but we're just not humanly capable of doing that, at least without, you know, some sort of aid from, you know, pharmaceuticals that is probably not good for us either in
right,
the longer run.
Right.
So there's a breaking point, and you got to understand that a lot of employers, you know, that are observant, they're able to detect this. If somebody is, you know, at the point of stress or, you know, really fatigued, it doesn't make any sense from the employer's standpoint to keep lumping on longer shift day after day without any time off, even for salaried folks where they're not legally required, you know, to pay extra for the extra hours. So a lot of employers and supervisors will understand when you get just to that point and cease to do that. But then again, there's a good share of them.
The other part, I think, is that a lot of employers, and I'm talking about maybe not so much middle management, but certainly upper management, they don't work those type of hours. So therefore, they don't understand the impact and the toll. And I think it's easy just to sit in a chair and say, well, you need to work 7 days this week and maybe a couple of 12-hour days in there. And by the way, I'm going home at 3 o'clock.
Well, I think there's something to that. What's probably more common, Bill, is the managers are working the very long hours, but the nature of the job is different. So it's less routine. It's maybe less physically demanding. And we also know from other studies that workers with long-hour managerial and professional type of jobs also get a lot of control over the number and especially the timing of those hours. So if they want to leave early one day, even if they have a lot of work to do, they can bring it home, they can do it the next day to catch up, whereas a lot of folks that don't have that choice are really the ones at risk. So it's not so much that they work a shorter work week, at least on the average, you know, the data that I see.
Yeah.
It's that they have a lot more control over the timing and the pace of work and the kinds of things that will mitigate some of these health and safety effects.
And if you just joined us, you're listening to Labor Radio, and we're talking to Lonnie Golden, associate professor from Penn State University, on excessive overtime. So, Lonnie, you talked about it several times now, mandatory and voluntary overtime. What is there a difference? I mean, I know what the difference is to me. What is the difference between the two?
There's not a real formal difference, but all we can detect is by looking at surveys, when you ask people if they're working overtime hours or if you worked extra days last week or last month, you can follow up and ask folks, was it because it was required by your employer? And on the basis of that, you know, that if people are being honest, they'll certainly tell you that, you know, these are hours that I prefer to have off, but I worked extra because I was asked to do so, or I was required to do so. And in fact, in most jobs where there is mandatory overtime work, if you refuse it, the employer is totally within their rights to discipline you, you know, to the point of discharge even.
Absolutely.
If you refuse.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, I'm a victim of overtime. And I chose that word carefully because I do believe I'm a victim. I wanted to use the word kidnapped because I'm being held against my will. And I know you can say, oh, Bill, just quit your job and go somewhere else. Okay. But it's not easy to do that today. Sometimes I do feel like I'm kidnapped on the sixth or seventh day or in the 11th or 12th hour. And I got to tell you, to me, the difference between voluntary and mandatory overtime, I don't think there's a difference in the effect of it. I think I'm fatigued and make mistakes and all that stuff goes along, whether it's voluntary or mandatory. But I think it's the morale of the workers when it's mandatory. It tends to, I don't know, you think with your coworkers there's some camaraderie, and they're all in the same spot that you are. But I see a lot of problems because it is forced. And again, I use the word victim, and I chose that word very carefully.
Well, I think there's something to that. Everybody's got a breaking point where even if they enjoy their work, and they obviously enjoy the income from additional work, there's a point at which it doesn't become worth it anymore. In terms of the sacrifice you make, not only on your own well-being, but in the time you could have used for other purposes.
Right.
So the biggest effect we see on folks who are working overtime generally, and especially for those who have it that's required by their employer, is a compounding effect of the latter on the interference they experience between their work and family life.
Mm-hmm.
And it stands to reason that if you're sacrificing additional hours in the evening, it's going to be harder to attend to parenting responsibilities and very hard to do the juggling act, especially in dual-earner households.
Right, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit because, you know, there are different aspects of, I'm not talking about a couple hours here or there on overtime. I'm talking about excessive overtime. I think 10% is probably I don't want to say a normal range, but when you get into the 15, maybe 18, 20% range of overtime, I'm thinking that's pretty excessive and it takes its toll. And some of the effects are on health. You just mentioned families. You can attend, you know, different functions, or even when you attend those functions, you're just so tired you don't really participate at a proper level. But there's also like health, effects on health, fatigue, communities, customers, morale, all those. Could you speak to any of those?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of our research is finding that, it's particularly that interference with family life and the difficulty in finding time not only for the usual routines, but especially for the emergency or the hard to anticipate stuff to take care of family matters is very difficult. And you're right, it's going to accumulate. It might not be today or tomorrow, but after weeks of that, without any time for recovery, people do say that if they're working overtime generally, they experience more stress from work. And if they work overtime because it's mandatory, it's even a compounding effect above that, that they are more likely to say, for instance, that they find work stressful often or always. And so in some cases, there aren't really large effects, but there's indications that people say they're more frequently coming home work too tired to do the chores, or to take care of themselves through recreation.
Right. You come home from work, you sit down on the couch, you watch a half hour TV, and you go to bed and get up the next day and go to work and do it all over again.
Right, and it's a real dilemma because there is a trade off. You do wind up, especially when the overtime is voluntary, with a little more income, but it's a quality of life that we're after with
Absolutely.
With work, and I think that that can really suffer in ways that many of us employees don't realize until it might be too late.
Right. So does the Fair Labor Standards Act help in any way on excessive overtime?
Fair Labor Standards Act, in a way, does, because we know that it certainly deters employers from scheduling overtime hours that they might have had they not had to pay extra. But over the years, overtime has become, again, this kind of privilege, because it's the only way to keep your income up with expenses if you're on hourly pay and you're in a competitive industry, or your employers are taking advantage of market conditions to restrain wages. For whatever reason, that means that workers find either extra jobs or extra hours at their current job is the only way to build up their incomes.
Right. So there's no actual law that limits. I know I called BOLI, Bureau of Labor and Industry, in this state, and basically their response was, and I mean, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, as long as they're paying you, they can work you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
The only thing we've seen in the last few years recently developing on that front is that certain states have taken it upon themselves to pass legislation that would either limit this additional overtime, limit the mandatory overtime hours, or pass or consider a legal right to refuse. So there's no strict numerical definition of how much is excessive overtime. But there are laws, again, they're just targeted to the healthcare sectors right now.
Right, absolutely.
But about a dozen states and another dozen or so are considering adopting regulations so that if you're working in some sort of healthcare profession, particularly because the public safety is at risk, not so much the employee health and safety, but because of the effects on the public with medical errors or accidents, that there are some sort of limits that they would have to face, or a right to refuse. Yeah, especially like a whole additional shift, or it leaves it up to the employee's discretion. So if they're asked to work another 2 hours or maybe four, they might feel that they're not at risk, or feel like it's not interfering with the other aspects of their life. But again, some of these states have passed legislation like this, and that's really kind of where the action is. It has been spreading.
So it's state mandate, not a federal.
That's right.
And
there are federal bills proposed, but they're not going to go anywhere.
No,
not
for at least a couple of years. Maybe in 07, when 06 is over, we might start making some headway.
Could be.
Yeah. Folks, that's your key to get out there and do something about the next election. So, Lonnie, you know, the employers I see depend on overtime. I've always thought, you know, okay, it is somewhat cheaper because when you add up the health care cost and the benefits package and versus what you're paying somebody for some overtime and not paying those benefits, it is cheaper to work some overtime. Is there a threshold at which it becomes more expensive to work employees overtime, and why do those employers choose to work their employees excessive overtime?
Well, I think you got the formula right, and it's really hard for employers to calculate to find that point after which it makes sense not to work overtime but to hire somebody else. But they're much more aware of the upfront costs of how much it costs to add another employee when you also have to cover them in the increasingly expensive health insurance pool and, you know, pay Social Security and all that, that it makes kind of short-term rational sense to just add in an extra day or a few extra hours and keep forestalling that point. But what's hard to compute from a conscientious employer standpoint is at what point do I risk the injuries and accidents that would be and other hazards that would be, you know, a monumental increase in our costs if some accident happens. So maybe they're pushing it to see how far they can go. And, you know.
And you talk about this increased risk, and I know I read some studies where, like, in the 12th hour, you're twice as likely to have an accident than in the 8th hour.
Exactly.
And, yeah, and you know, when some of the studies I've read define excessive as, you know, like 10% in that, you know, that's of your 40-hour work week. But if you're working 15 or 18 or 19%, but you talked about the increased risk in accident and of course, cost to the employer. There are studies to back that up that say yes. When you overwork employees, this is what's going to happen. Are there not?
Yeah. I mean, it's no guarantee. Obviously, it's all just probabilities and risk, but they certainly go up with the length of the workday. And the stuff I mentioned earlier, how much time are you giving them off or rest breaks during the shifts or, you know, the quality of rest they get. So when we look at a sector like trucking, when they're working long shifts and the quality of sleep you're going to get in your cabin might not meet what it does for, you know, in a hotel bed.
Right.
Then
especially
there's all
the
these
team
other
and
factors.
There's two drivers. There's two drivers and the one guy's trying to sleep while the other guy's driving.
Right.
I mean that's definitely not, you know, restful sleep.
You got it. So yeah. It's the kind of stuff that's really hard to measure, like the quality of sleep that's going to determine whether you can go 10 hours without much of a risk of accident or just 8 or as long as 12.
Yeah.
So it depends on all these other factors, but that is certainly a sector where we have to look at it more carefully when it also involves the public safety.
So you said earlier in the discussion that you were taking, I know the study I read was, I think, 2002. You said you're taking another look at the statistics now?
Yeah, I'm looking at this one large national survey which asked people not only about their work hours and whether or overtime was mandatory, but how they answer questions about their level of stress and health and injury rate.
And that's how long does it take you to do a study like that?
Too long.
Too long.
Mandatory overtime.
Well, just work some overtime
voluntary.
And get it done.
It's voluntary overtime, but I get to choose when I time it. But I have some papers coming out on that, and with my co-author, and it's a unique study because we're actually able to connect this question of whether you work long hours per se and whether it was required by the employer with these indicators of your health and well-being.
Right. So what do you do with these studies? I mean, I know how I'm using them. I'm going in and trying to beat up my employer with it. and by the way, I'm doing pretty good at it. Thank
well,
you.
Yeah, my pleasure. there are some employers that do comprehend, let's say in the construction sector, that it doesn't make much sense to work really long hours or long shifts, because the costs of the accidents are so expensive, not only for, you know, severing a limb of an employee, of course, but in terms of their worker compensation insurance. So if the costs are really apparent to them, they're not going to be as willing to risk it. But if you're talking about a sector where it's very cost competitive, they don't know about their long-term survival as an enterprise anyhow, they're under pressure from not only market competition, but maybe a supervisor's under pressure from his superior, you know, to crunch out a little more output from their existing employees before they hire, and to go ahead and push the envelope on some of these risks. That's how this develops.
So there's a lot of aspects that really don't come into these reports, and I mean, you know, by listening to what you just said, each employer has different reasons for doing different things,
yeah.
And we can't really pull all of that into one report.
Right, and like in certain sectors, it's hard to detect the near misses as well, right, the near accidents, and how close you get to that point where you've overworked a nurse or you've overworked an airline pilot or...
Well, you can also overwork the forklift driver in a warehouse.
That's exactly right, and unless there's a risk to public safety, it tends to go unnoticed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's why the healthcare. I did notice when I did research for this show that the healthcare sector seems to have a lot of states that has limits on mandatory overtime.
That's it. So that's where advocates of promoting a right to refuse unwanted overtime or some sort of limitation per week or per day, that's where it's largely occurring because there are these public safety risks. But there are other sectors as well in the transportation sector, for example. That it might not be quite as sensational as, you know, medical errors, but we just sort of take for granted that, you know, in the middle of the night there's going to be accidents and the innocents, you know, will get maimed or die.
Right. So
these are preventable if, you know, if we just don't push that additional hour or two.
Right. If someone dies in the hospital because of the wrong medication, that's newsworthy.
Right, but, if we find out about it.
Right. But if someone's hurt on a forklift, or if someone's in a an accident inside of a yard, or maybe even just an office worker gets hurt for some reason, that's certainly not newsworthy, and we're not going to hear any of that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we just take that for granted as a factor of the workplace. Our injury rates have gone down, but they could go down a lot more.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting thing is, as a victim of excessive overtime, I can tell by the, it's not, you start work on Monday and then you get to work, or you have to work Saturday and Sunday, and you feel pretty good by Sunday, and you're thinking, well, I can do this, but then comes along Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday of the following week. And you throw in some 12 hours there, and you start thinking to myself, well, maybe I can't do this, And how do I relay that feeling in a report or to my boss so that he gets it, Because he can just look at me and say, oh, you just don't want to do the overtime, you're just faking.
Well, I'm sure the coach of the Portland Trail Blazers doesn't play even his best players all 48 minutes, right? I mean, there's a point at which it doesn't make sense to even have your best, most productive, best in shape employees to keep them at their peak performance level.
Excellent. Well, Lonnie, I was waiting for another guest to call in, and she hasn't called in. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to keep you on the phone, and we'll just keep talking here.
Do I have a choice?
No, this is mandatory overtime.
That's voluntary.
Okay, thank you. So let's go back and just kind of recap a little bit, and hopefully we'll get our next guest to call in. Studies have been done. Overtime to some extent is okay. Overtime to some extent is welcome. But there is a point, and it's the definition of that point, that why you do studies.
I think that especially in the medical and health research communities, they do those studies. I'm actually a labor economist, so I'm interested in related issues like this trade-off between income and the risks. But, in the health and occupational health and psychology fields, they're very interested in finding that point, at least for a given industry type or occupation type, to find that precise point at which the risks really escalate. And to try and encourage either voluntary
compliance.
Efforts or compliance with this. But you have to get the information out there that, after the 11th hour, the risk doubles and you're really putting yourself at risk as an employer in terms of your costs going up. You just have to consider more widely than a lot of employers do, what is the cost? And if you're burning out an employee or you're combining with other factors, leading one to take risks that have developing stress and injuries because of fatigue.
You think it could be as simple as education to employers?
I think it's part of the process, but you can't just rely on education alone. Nor can you rely on just regulation alone either. It's really just you need a multi-pronged effort to get the information available. I mean, to me, the most amazing thing is how few employers actually ask their employees about these. Because there might be some employees that, whether they overestimate their own abilities to function under fatigue. But you should be asking employees, are you feeling like you need an extra day off, or you need a shorter shift, or you need a longer rest break? And, again, there are plenty of examples of conscientious employers who do this. Either they learn the hard way or just understand it tacitly by having worked a job like that it doesn't make any sense from the production standpoint to go past that point of taking really large risks of injury and illness and accidents.
So with this study, have you done any presentations at corporations or companies and used this study, and have you had any success?
Not yet. My role is basically to get that out in the journals so that the reporters and the media outlets like you pick up on this and see that there's probably you know, some science involved with estimating this, and maybe we could get our workplace practices and maybe state and federal regulations a little more science-based and not just determined by who's got the most political power or sway with legislators.
Or just say, gee, I don't want to work Saturday because I don't want to work Saturday. You know, here's why I don't want to work Saturday, because I had to work 12 hours 3 days last week and last Saturday and Sunday, and I need to get out of here.
Right. I mean, maybe some employees find the workplace comforting like that, and you don't want to deny them that opportunity if it improves their quality of life and their income along with it or income prospects in the future. But I would much more rather see the type of workplace where employees are constantly being asked or encouraged to not push themselves beyond that point. And I think it would be better for all in the long run.
Well, I suppose the employer could say, you know, if you had if it was all voluntary and then no one was working overtime, you know, the complaint would be, well, gee, I can't ever get anybody to work any overtime.
There are some workplaces like that, and maybe it's because they have parenting responsibilities. And you're right, there's a little give and take, and there's a little bit of tug of war there in terms of inducing folks to work overtime. But, again, they got to find that point after which it doesn't make sense, even if they're voluntarily supplying this additional work time, that it's not in the employee's interest, that it can burn them out or lead them to get, like some folks, for instance, person I'm talking to be at that frustration point, that you're considering other careers, you know. The nurses, for instance, are in this vicious cycle where because there's this nursing shortage, particularly in hospitals, that it's hard to keep people in that profession. So on the sidelines of that profession are millions, probably, of nurses who were trained as nurses or one-time worked as nurses that are no longer willing, especially in the hospital setting, to be practicing their own profession. So it sort of compounds itself that the more people are on the sidelines, the more burden there is on the existing nursing workforce, and the harder it is to draw people into that profession without, like what employers are doing now, is offering steep bonuses and cash payments in order to attract people into their workplaces to come work for them for a couple of years.
Right. I mean, with nursing, you know, that registered nurse, I mean, I understand that problem because there's a supply and demand, and we're not turning out enough nurses, or maybe the pay wasn't there for a while, or the environment wasn't the right environment for a while. I know they're trying to create a better environment now.
Right.
But when we get right down to some of the lower end of the jobs, I mean, and I keep going back to like a forklift job.
Right.
There can't be a lack of supply of forklift drivers or warehouse workers or order fillers or truck drivers, or there can't be a lack of that type of, people trying to find decent work to say that we have a problem with staffing.
Well, I think you're right. I think there's two kind of deterrents of even your, you know, good employer, that they can argue that they can't find people, but what they really mean is they don't have the resources to go recruit people and train them. And, of course, that's iffy in some cases, so there are many employers who overstate this. On the other hand, they do face that real cost that if they want to include the person, a new employee, in the insurance pool, that's gotten increasingly expensive. And I suppose the last thing we'd want them to do is say, well, we're going to hire people but not include them in the health insurance pool or the pension plan. So they just try to go out along as long as they can with the existing workforce. And
until somebody brings some of these studies in and throws it in their face and says, hey, wait a minute, we have a problem here.
Yeah, and to see that this is going to cost them as well. It's not just the cost of, you know, seeking out people to fill the positions or the cost of training, which it can be quite substantial if there are a lot of skills involved and it takes people away from their production, their usual job. That is an important cost. But there are other costs to not doing that, and that's what I think we have to have more heightened awareness about.
Okay. Well, Lonnie, I got to tell you, I've kept you on overtime long enough. I apologize.
My pleasure.
But I very thoroughly enjoyed the discussion. And I guess I'm going to have you punch out now because, you know, the check's getting too big and I can't afford this. So do you have anything to close with?
I think we just have to have a more heightened awareness again about this from employees who might be underestimating what toll the additional overtime might take on them and their family until it's too late. And for employers to understand that they too can intervene without having to have new state regulation by being more conscious of these risks that they take and passing along costs or making costs longer term and cumulative rather than just facing it up front, that that it's not worth it, that there's a limit to even what strong, able-bodied folks can do physically or mentally, and that you'll have a happier, higher morale, and probably more productive workforce over the longer haul if you act sooner rather than later.
Okay. Well, Lonnie, I got to tell you, I have been recording this program, and my idea is I'm going to take it back and hand it to my boss tomorrow. So fortunately, he doesn't know where you are. But so Lonnie Golden, associate professor from Penn State University, I appreciate you taking this extended time and talking about overtime issues. And when you get that new report done, I'd really like to take a look at it.
I'll do that. And you just keep working hard and playing hard, but don't overwork.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
You take care. Bye.
Okay, and on the program tonight, we also have Robert Schwartz. Robert is author of many handbooks written in easy-to-understand format for union workers. Bob, welcome to Labor Radio in Portland.
Glad to be here.
So, Bob, you have a lot of books, I got to tell you, and a lot of excellent books. Let's talk a little bit about your background. What brought you to writing these books?
Well, I guess I've been writing labor books for about 25 years. Before I was a lawyer, I was active in the student movement and in the movement against the war and in various types of organizing, including Teamster organizing. So when I went to law school,
you organized your fellow warehouse workers into the union, right?
Yes, we did.
Yeah,
we
did. Okay.
We organized into a Teamsters local.
Okay. So the expertise, you know, I'm sure it's learned, but it also comes from being in the trenches and actually working at jobs and seeing what union stewards and workers in particular needed to protect their rights.
Yes, I always thought back to the experiences that I had, and when I started to learn about labor law, it was always a thought in my mind that I could translate that those rules into a language which people could understand.
Well, I got to tell you, I can't understand it, and these books are excellent. And if you are a union steward, a union member, thinking about joining a union, wondering why people belong to unions, I highly suggest these books, and we're going to go through some of them tonight. And, you know, we'll go over a little bit of the material in them. One of the books that when I first became a steward, a union steward years ago, I went to the library and I asked if they had any books on union stewards, and they all kind of looked at me like I was, you know, off the wall. And they ended up handing me one book, and I'm not sure what it said, but it was about, I don't know, 7 inches thick, and it was printed in like 1938 or something. And it absolutely did me no good at all until I bumped into your book, Legal Rights of a Steward. Excellent book. I didn't even realize I had legal rights. What are some of the legal rights of a union steward?
Well, a union steward has a special status under the National Labor Relations Act, which is the most important law in the United States. The law recognizes that stewards have a tough job, that part of their job is to confront management and to stand up for the workers that they represent. So the law says that when the steward is conducting union business and representing other workers, he's not just a rank-and-file employee or a regular employee. He has a special status. He has the status of being equal with management. He can take part in some of the same types of conduct that a boss can. He can speak loudly. He can gesture. he can make accusations. If he thinks the boss is lying, he can say so.
Right, whereas as if you're just an employee and you went in and started yelling at your boss or maybe said a cuss word or told him he was lying, he could turn around and say, there's the door, see you later.
Absolutely.
But a union steward is protected under law.
That's right. The boss has to tolerate behavior and conduct from a steward that he would never have to tolerate from a rank-and-file employee.
Right, but let's be clear about this because you can't walk in and punch your boss.
No, it's not 100% equality.
Exactly.
Maybe it's 80%.
Yeah, so but it's something and it's good.
It means that when a steward gets into an argument and the boss accuses him of going too far, the steward doesn't have to get paralyzed with fear and worry that he's going to get fired. He knows the boss is just trying to divert him from what he's trying to do, which is to argue his case or to get justice for the workers that he's representing.
So if you go in and your boss starts yelling at you, you can yell back at your boss.
Yes.
Or if he starts cussing and swearing at you, you get to cuss and swear back at him.
Yes.
And that is all protected.
Yes. Okay. Yes, it is. Up to a point.
Right.
Up to a point.
That's what I wanted to get. Up to a point.
Certainly, you can't threaten to assault him. You can't even put your hand on him in any way. You can't take part in sort of unrestrained profanity. But you can use what's called salty language. You can use words which you couldn't use on the shop floor.
Right. And I mean, it's tough being a union steward because it's a thankless job. And most times, and you know, you're giving the task of going and solving something that the boss obviously doesn't want solved. He just wants to be able to run roughshod over any of the rules or regulations and do what he wants to do. And oftentimes, it's when you go in and have these discussions, it's right in the heat of the moment.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's tough, and I'm glad to see these protections. But I think a lot of workers, you know, and again, you know, whether you're a union steward, a union member, or if you're, you know, thinking about joining a union or wondering why people belong to a union, we can go talk about wages and benefits and pension and health care and all that kind of stuff. But to me, it kind of gets down to this stuff, the ability to go in and talk to the boss and have a level playing field.
I think you're on to pretty much what I've been trying to say.
Yeah, exactly. And again, folks, this book, Legal Rights of a Union Steward, the format is excellent. It goes through and it details what your rights are, why they're your rights, how to implement those rights, and then at the end of every chapter, it has questions and answers.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask questions, you know, what a normal steward on the shop floor would be asking, and you give an answer. And I just think that is, to me, this clarified my role as a union steward. And I just wanted to say thank you very much for doing that.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering how many union stewards across the country are saying the same thing I am. So let me pat you on the back here for a few minutes, Bob, because this is good stuff.
Okay.
This is excellent.
I don't mind hearing it.
Okay. And one other thing I wanted to touch on under the Legal Rights of a Steward Handbook is the Weingartner rights.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, would you explain those a little bit, please?
Well, the phrase Weingartner rights comes from a U.S. Supreme Court decision in which dealt with a cashier at a supermarket who had been brought in to see the security, and the accusation was made that she had done something dishonest as a cashier. She had let some friends go through the line without paying, and they wanted to question her about that, and she asked if she could have her steward present, and the company refused and insisted that she had to answer those questions alone, and they interrogated her in a harsh manner and eventually fired her for theft and dishonesty. And the union contested the matter and took it to the board and said that she had a right to have her steward present. And the NLRB agreed, and then the company appealed, and it went to the Supreme Court. And they used that case as an opportunity to sort of lay out a number of rules applying to interrogations of employees. And most importantly, to say that, yes, a steward, a worker does have the right to request a steward, and the company, once that request is made, the company has to stop asking questions and has to bring the steward in.
So it's actually that powerful. If I'm in interrogation and I say, I want my steward, and the boss says, no, you can't have your steward, I get to say, I don't want to answer any more questions?
That's right. The worker does not have to answer questions if his request for a steward is denied.
Right. So let me ask you, Bob, if that same case went to the Supreme Court today, what do you think the decision would be?
Well,
could be a little different, obviously.
You're aware, of course, that the court is in a very conservative phase and is getting much more conservative. So, sure. These days, I don't think the NLRB would actually have ruled the way it did, because the National Labor Relations Board, which is the highest arbiter of labor law, is now totally controlled by extreme right-wing, anti-labor, pro-business individuals. So they wouldn't. They probably wouldn't even have ruled that a steward has to be there.
Right. One of your other books, Bob, and if you just join us, we're talking to Bob Schwartz. He's author of numerous help books for union people, union stewards in particular. Legal Rights of a Union Steward. One of my other favorites is the FMLA Handbook. That's the Family Medical Leave Act. This one that I have is, I'm going to have to go buy another one. This one's kind of worn out. The pages are starting to fall out in it. And it's an excellent book, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. I want to get to one of your other books called How to Win Past Practice Grievances.
Mm-hmm.
And could you explain to our listeners what a past practice is?
Well, simply speaking, a past practice is a customary way of doing things, something that has been done in a certain way over, say, at least 3 or 4 or 5 years. Something, but it's also something that has not been written down into the contract. So it's a practice which both parties, both the employer and the union, understand. They both are aware of it, and they both accept it, but they just haven't gotten far enough to write it into the contract, perhaps because they felt that it's so obvious and so accepted that why waste the time in negotiations to put it in writing.
So an example may be, my boss buys me pizza every Friday. I've been there 20 years, and every Friday he buys me pizza. And one day he comes out and says, I'm no longer buying you pizza. Is that a past practice?
Well, it's a past practice. There's two questions to be asked. One, is it a past practice? And two, if it is a past practice, is it the type of past practice that the courts and labor arbitrators consider binding? So the first question as to whether it's a past practice, it's probably a past practice, although a practice that just applies to one individual employee is usually not considered a past practice. Mm-hmm. In order to have the status of a past practice, we usually expect it to apply to at least two or more employees. So who's getting that pizza it would be my first question. If it's just you, just your boss buying you a pizza, maybe not. If he's buying a pizza for the group, then definitely it is a past practice.
Okay, and as a past practice, it has some status. I mean, as a union, we get to go in and negotiate over the fact that he doesn't want to buy the entire group pizza anymore?
Well, if he's been buying the group or the department pizza for 20 years, and people expect that and have grown to rely on that, then it's a kind of a past practice which most labor arbitrators would consider binding, mm-hmm. because it's a practice which applies to benefits. It provides an important benefit or a privilege to employees. And those are the kinds of practices that, even though they're not written, many arbitrators consider to be part of the collective bargaining agreement. But if the practice was of a different type, for example, let's say a group of office workers have been using typewriters for 20 years, and then management decides they want to bring in computers. Well, the typewriters are a past practice, but they're not a binding past practice.
Okay. So it's not an easy thing to decide what is and what isn't.
No.
Okay.
The main distinction is between a practice which is personal or provides a benefit or a privilege, as compared to a practice which deals with how the work is being performed.
Right. So you said something about written and not written. So let me ask a question, and I know there's different, I guess I could say different levels of past practice. Is that a right way of saying that?
Well, there's different categories.
Categories, okay. And so the pizza example, that's probably in a low-level category, I would imagine. And let's say we have a contract that says, let's say vacations. I get a week vacation for 1 year and 2 weeks and 3 weeks and however it all works out. But it's not really clear on when or how many people get those vacations.
Yes.
And now there's a vacation policy. And that vacation policy states, and it has stated for, I don't know, 20 years or since the earth's been cooling, that this many people get the time off, and if this happens, you know, whatever else goes on. But it's a written policy. How strong of a case is that if the boss wants to come out and change that written policy?
Well, I would say that if the practice that we're talking about is in writing, and if that, especially if the employer has written that up, then that helps you to say that this is a practice which is accepted by management, and it's a practice which management expects to continue. And consequently, it's reasonable for the union and for the employees to expect it to continue. So sure, it's always great when you see some sort of a memorandum which describes the practice that you are trying to enforce.
Hmm. So it's clarifying something.
But the fact that it's in writing gives it makes it much closer towards being a binding past practice. But the best way to make a practice binding, or the best way to argue that a practice is binding, is to do what you're saying, is to say that the practice relates to a written provision of the contract. Now, when the parties negotiated the contract, they didn't have time, or they didn't have the energy, or they didn't have the desire to lay out the vacation policy in detail. They gave the bare bones of the policy, how many weeks per year you get, how many weeks you get depending on your amount of service, but how vacations are chosen, who can take them at the same time. Those small details, they didn't take the time to negotiate because they expected to allow that the parties would work that out in practice. And in fact, if they have worked it out in practice over 20 years or 10 years or even 5 years, most labor arbitrators would consider that practice to reflect what the parties intended the vacation clause and how they expected that clause to be implemented.
Excellent. That's good news for me, Bob.
Well, I hope it applies to a real case.
Again, where could people get some of these books? If we have some union stewards out there that are interested, or union people, or again, I view these books are very helpful to union stewards. I get that.
Well, the two most direct ways is to call the 800 number and to order the books on the phone, and the number is 800-576-4552, and that's the number of Work Rights Press, which publishes these books. The other most direct way is to go on the internet to www.workrightspress.com. That's one word, workrightspress.com, and there's an order blank on the web. Otherwise, you can go on Amazon.
Okay. And again, that number is 1-800-576-4552.
Correct.
Okay. And folks, I got to tell you, these are excellent books. I just and I know, Bob, you've come to, I know we've been to some Teamster events that you've come in and done some classes and you've worked out of the books, and I hear nothing but positive results coming out of that. Years later, I hear people, well, you know, I learned this in Schwartz's class.
But I hope you're not going to leave me without talking about the most recent book.
No, I was just going to ask you about that.
There's a lot of Teamster stuff in it.
Okay. Your newest book, Strikes, right. Picketing, and Inside Campaigns. What brought this book on?
Well, you know, there's just no book out there that explains the rules regarding strikes and secondary activity and picketing and lockouts that has been accessible to union people. That information has been here and there and really hasn't been put together. So there's a big need for it, and a lot of people said that to me, including Tom Leedham, who's I think active in your area.
Absolutely.
And has had a lot of experience with strikes and picketing, and he encouraged me to one of the people who encouraged me to put this book together.
Right. There's a difference between good experience and bad experience when you're talking about strikes.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of victories and there's a lot of defeats.
Right. Well, Bob, we have about 30 seconds left. Again, I just want to promote these books. Anybody, please, if you're looking for some answers, these are the books to find them in. Bob, anything to close with?
Well, I just say that the next few years are probably going to be pretty tough. Some of the most important labor rights that we have enjoyed are going to be weakened. There's no question about it. Going to be under attack. Right now, the National Labor Relations Board is in the hands of some of the worst people it's ever been in the hands of. So people have to persevere. Maybe that will change in a couple of years.
Right. And again, folks, that number for the book?
1-800-576-4552.
And also you can go to workersrightspress.com.
WorkRightsPress.com.
Absolutely, and order some of these books. And then if you do that and you use these books and you're successful, I want you to get a hold of me and we'll have you on the program and we'll let other people know why you were successful using these books.
Okay.
Bob, I'd like to thank you for taking time out and coming on to Labor Radio. I really appreciate it. And again, excellent work on these books.
Good. You're doing a good job. I wish we had a show like that in the Boston area.
Well, maybe I'll come up there later and we'll set something up.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it.
Come on, Bill.
And with that, folks, we'll end another Labor Radio. I hope everyone was interested in the overtime piece. And again, folks, these books by Robert Schwartz, I just can't say enough about them. They're chock full of information with questions and they're easy to understand. Go buy a couple. With that, I'll say goodnight and thank you. Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by AFSCME Local 3336, representing the employees of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality by advocating for working conditions, pay and benefits, supporting political activity that promotes pro-environment and pro-labor positions, strengthening labor coalitions, and actively organizing members. More information at AFSCME3336.org.